There was a period of time when my kids were young, when a good number of people that I've never met knew more about my children than many of my closest friends did. These people, they knew a little bit about me, too. They were, that I knew that I was a minister or that I lived in Colorado, for example. But about my kids, they knew all sorts of things. How Gracie was having trouble sleeping, or how we were a little worried about Joseph hitting his milestones at the time. These were minor things, really, not too big a deal for strangers to know. But they also knew other things, like about my kids' birth mom and their foster care journey. Things that still some of my closest friends don't know. Things I'd consider certainly too intimate to share from the pulpit, let alone with a bunch of people that I'd never even met. These people, as far as I know, shared only two obvious things in common. First, I'd have to guess, they likely lived in or near Olympia, Washington. And second, they all had a need for furniture. And they all decided to go look for that new furniture at a Macy's furniture gallery near the Olympia Mall, where my mother worked for over two decades. If any of you have met my mom, you might have already guessed that's where the story was going. My mom loved to share all the things about all her people with all those who came shopping for furniture. We even at one point decided to give in. We bought her one of those little flip books of pictures, just put a bunch of pictures in there so that way as she told the story, she had someone to point to. My mom has been a really good sport, given all the times I've talked about her in sermons, and I have talked about her a lot, and sometimes not in the most flattering light. I appreciate this so much because my mom does make for the best stories. But other than asking me to sometimes to make sure that people know that even though she did have a hard time when I first came out, she came around, and now she's my partner's biggest fan. Always, whenever I tell about some of those early stages, she'll call me up and she'll say, "Couldn't you tell them the end?" So there you go. Whenever I tell you about those hard times, now you know the end. But other than that request, she mostly just runs with it, which I've always thought was because she knows, given her impulse to share with anyone and everyone, my whole entire life, anything and everything, it's basically all fair now. I didn't send her a text telling her to watch the live stream today, but she might get word, so we'll see what she thinks after this one. My mom's tendency for TMI has meant I've spent much of my life trying to sort out that question of what to share, or when, and with whom. TMI, that is, too much information. It isn't a phrase that's just indicating like you're providing too much detail. It's more like what you're sharing is too personal or intimate to be shared at all, perhaps, or at least to be shared with the person or persons that you're happening to be sharing it with right then. TMI. The phrase didn't exist when I was growing up, or I would have said it a lot, I'm guessing, both to my mom and sometimes to myself. As a kid, I was simultaneously the one that had their arm raised in the air, just hoping that somebody would call on me all the time. And also, I was the kid that felt total shame and embarrassment after having shared anything, even if it wasn't actually TMI. Researcher and writer Brené Brown calls the shame that comes after sharing a vulnerability hangover. Brown is known for her work around vulnerability. She describes it as the birthplace of belonging, the practice of showing up with our authentic, imperfect selves and letting ourselves be seen. The flip side to this courageous practice, though, is, as she says, you know, that feeling when you wake up and everything feels fine, and then you remember, and the memory of laying yourself open washes over you and you want to hide under the covers forever. That feeling is the vulnerability hangover. Thinking back over the past few Sundays here at Foothills and our Be Real series, one of the moments that stands out for me is the Sunday after our Me Too service. It was Easter Sunday, which is usually one of the most upbeat services that we have all year. People come in kind of ready for that sense of hope, and they're eager for a sense of excitement and energy. But in the first few moments, in all three of the services on Easter Sunday, there was instead an uncharacteristic kind of tentativeness, like a kind of shyness, a tenderness. Did you notice? Between the service, Sean and I, we checked in, like, wow, what is going on? This is, like, weird for Easter. We did get to the usual Easter feeling by about midway through the services, but all three of them started out with a kind of nervousness. I think Sean was the one to wonder aloud, oh, maybe they're having a vulnerability hangover. You know, the Me Too service was intensely vulnerable for many of us, and coming back into the space as a community for that first time, consciously or subconsciously, maybe it just hit us, that space in us that I felt as a little kid, first so grateful to have been called on, and then after having talked, wondering if maybe I had shared too much. What in the world was I thinking? It's why I thought, we planned four Sundays in the Be Real series, but as we got closer, I started to think maybe we needed a PS, which is today on TMI. Vulnerability is a tricky thing, not just for me or my mom. It's tricky for all of us. It is the thing we are drawn to in others. When you think back over the most powerful interactions that you've ever had, often they are when someone was willing to share something quite vulnerable. But also, as Brown says, it is often the thing we are repelled by in ourselves. We see it as courage in others and inadequacy in ourselves. The vulnerability hangover, unlike other sorts of hangovers, doesn't necessarily mean that we shared too much, but more that we pushed ourselves outside our comfort zone. And the hide under the covers feeling reflects the fear that what we have shared will have revealed us as unworthy or less than, that we will become reduced to our disclosure rather than heard in the fullness of our truth, and that rather than the connection we were seeking, we will instead experience the opposite: judgment, rejection, more shame. This is why I almost always assume that the thing that someone talks to me about may not be the thing they actually want to talk about. People need to be seen and heard and known, not just want, actually need. We need to be seen and heard and known. It's why we did the series on Be Real in the first place. It is a basic human need, this longing to belong, not as the person you wish you were or the person the world says you should be, but as you, flawed and also whole, good and also still learning. But we are also scared of being seen and heard and known, and so we are also unpracticed at sharing and revealing. So we say other things than the thing that would help us be seen and heard and known. Other things that keep us mostly safe and protected. We share our opinions. We disclose our expertise, sometimes at length. We debate ideas and politicians that we don't know personally. We offer insights that keep our, for the most part, keep our real selves shielded, our struggles shielded, but also keep us inevitably frustrated and angry that we aren't being seen and heard and known. I try to remember when someone is especially heated in their idea sharing or especially passionate in their analysis of a situation, large or small, that behind that fire is likely a huge longing to connect, to be seen and heard and known. In a small group I was leading a couple of years ago, we were exploring these sorts of questions, and one of the participants shared that one of the main reasons that she was in the group was because she really wanted to learn how to share and express her feelings, but in an appropriate way. When she said that, I thought to myself, that is maybe the most Unitarian thing to say ever. Because we do have feelings. We want to offer them appropriately. We so often, as Unitarian Universalists, struggle with this. We are so often well-versed in academics, or in business, or in social or political activism, but knowing how we feel as individuals in our own lives, and then learning how to name those feelings and the stories behind them, and then maybe even the underlying need they connect to, and then sharing those stories with others in an appropriate way. We are beginners. Which means that sometimes in our attempts to be seen and heard and known, we do the opposite of holding back on our stories, and instead we go all in and suddenly find ourselves knee-deep in TMI. Perhaps you are familiar with that impulse when you've just met someone, they seem really great, and you have a lot in common, and suddenly, and you've been having this story you've been wanting to talk about, this thing that happened, and you want to talk to somebody about it, and they seem great, so you just go ahead and launch right into this thing that you're struggling with, and you really vulnerable story or reality about your life. I wish I could say that when I was thinking about this, I didn't have an example immediately come to mind. I'm sure none of you have a story in mind. For me, it was a couple of years ago. I was having coffee with a potential new friend. She seemed great. We'd hung out a little before in kind of large groups, but we decided to sit down, have coffee, and after a few sips, I launched in and fully overshared. I knew it about 3/4 of the way into my story, but it was too late. I still blush when I think about it. It's not easy to make friends as adults. Sometimes we want to skip ahead. You know, get to the part where we're talking for real. It happens. But what's interesting about these moments of oversharing is that actually they have the same impact as not sharing at all. Which is why Brown theorizes that oversharing is just as much a strategy to avoid vulnerability as undersharing. Because oversharing attempts to manifest connection before the connection has actually been earned. It tries to gain that connection without actually risking real intimacy. Instead, it's like a test. Like to see if this relationship is going to actually have the trust that it would need for real connection. But since oversharing often results in disconnection, distrust, disengagement, the answer to the trust question usually ends up being no, which just reinforces the skepticism that led us to overshare in the first place. I have found that this question of what to share and with whom and how much has not gotten any easier as a minister. It's maybe gotten even more confusing, as connection is like the main point of the job, and also our boundaries. This is true for any of us in a public role or in a position of trust, or let me just say, for any of us who are on social media, which, as Congress has been trying really hard to work out this week, is far from a private conversation. Carrie Newhoff, a Christian pastor and leadership teacher, talks about trying to navigate the question of sharing and oversharing, and how early in his career he was reticent to disclose anything personal about himself. And he definitely didn't want to share his struggles because he thought it was really important as a minister to have it all together. As he started to get more experience in ministry, however, he came to the same conclusion that we all do, that is impossible, which is it means he started to share more until at one point, he'd just gone through a time of serious burnout, and he was just coming out of it, and he decided to share with some people that what he had just gone through was with a class that he was teaching. He just launched right in it, told the whole story beginning to end. And afterwards, one of the organizers of the event came up to him and said, "Wow, that was tough. Are you sure you don't need some more counseling?" He realized instantly the mistake he had made. It wasn't that he shouldn't share the stories of his burnout with someone, but at that tender stage where they weren't fully processed, it probably wasn't yet the time to be sharing with these strangers enrolled in his leadership seminar. Newhoff says that since then he's been clear that you shouldn't share something with strangers that you haven't fully processed yourself, especially, again, in that position of trust or leadership. What you share in public are those things that you've worked through, to some degree at least. As the Reverend Nancy Bowen says, "I believe in the wounded healer, just not one that's actively bleeding." It's just messy. Whatever stuff you are still trying to work through, that stuff doesn't belong with anyone other than your inner circle, your trusted friends, and your family, which means you need an inner circle, trusted friends. And by that, I mean you need like one, maybe two, maybe three. That's a lot. Sometimes our culture gives us an idea that we should have a whole bunch of friends, these close friends, the inner circle, but that just is not the way it works. And plus, who would have the time? But one, maybe two, if you're three, if you're like the luckiest person ever, people that can go, as Brown says, and wade into the deep with you. And then maybe there's like another layer beyond that of people that you can share most of the stuff with, like two, three, four at most. Now, I already said, I know, it's hard to make friends as adults, especially when so many of us are transient these days. So you pick up and move at a time in life when there's no natural opportunity to make friends. But this week, it's been another week where I've been reminded of how much all this matters for all of us and for our world. If we're going to make it in these times, if we're going to find a way forward, if we're going to keep going, then seeing each other and hearing each other and holding each other, it needs our attention and commitment and discipline, which makes it sound way less fun than making friends and having friends actually is. My inner circle, when we get together, we spend a lot of time laughing. Even when we are wading in the deep, it's amazing, right? Belly aching, tear mixed, healing, laughter. This need for an inner circle and trying to figure that whole thing out is the reason that many people will come to church to make these sorts of friends. But even here, how to go about it isn't always obvious. I mean, if you go up to someone in the social hall after the service with your cup of coffee and launch into one of those stories you've been needing to share, I'm thinking you're going to get that same look that my potential friend gave me over our coffee date. Even here, it takes time, commitment, discipline, laughter. It takes joining a gather group or other small group if you haven't yet. It takes serving with others. It takes showing up, joining in, being real, as our series since January has been encouraging. There is no magic route to developing an inner circle, no fast track here or anywhere. It takes time. And worse than that, it takes failure. I mean, it takes being willing to trust people that end up being unworthy of your trust. And it takes opening yourself up to that rejection on all the ways that love just will not promise to stop breaking our hearts. But then, the amazing thing is, if you can keep your heart open through all of that, sometimes it works. Suddenly, that friend you've been building relationship with, being vulnerable with, sharing your stories of struggle with, they hear you into speech. They listen you into belonging. They hold you with an openness that simultaneously feels like home and the wide open sky all at once. Until we find ourselves laughing into healing and resilience, and find together that capacity to keep going and with joy. And so we keep trying. We keep practicing, keep showing up, keep sharing our stories, keep making space for the real, the brave, and the becoming more brave together. May it be so, and amen.